You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump issued a series of executive orders billed as COVID-19 economic relief efforts, but there are big questions over his authority to make some of those decisions. We'll check out the orders and the constitutional questions they raise. First, political ads are already filling airwaves and social media feeds here in Wisconsin, and we can expect more of the same in the months to come. Political misinformation is already a fact on the internet, but campaign ads are raising legal and ethical questions, too. In April, the Trump campaign filed a defamation lawsuit against a Rhinelander TV station for airing an ad from a third-party group critical of the president's coronavirus response. This month, Facebook and Twitter blocked a Trump campaign ad for violating their coronavirus misinformation policies. And President Trump's campaign released an ad this month that used edited images of Democratic candidate Joe Biden. These and other cases raise questions about the protections given to political speech and whether media and social media outlets have the obligation, the right, and the ability to stop false claims in these kind of ads. Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota and director of the Silla Center for Media Ethics and Law. Her books include Media Ethics Today. Jane, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, I know there's a lot of nooks and crannies and details here, but big picture, how much latitude, how much obligation do media outlets have to fact-check ads posted by campaigns and outside groups?
Well, let's start with kind of the simplest stuff. If we're talking about broadcast, television, radio, they have an obligation to run ads and give reasonable opportunity for ads to be bought by candidates themselves, legally qualified candidates, and their campaigns. And if they do sell them the time, they cannot censor what is provided. No matter what's in it, they have to air it as it was provided to them. The only exception to that is that if they fail to have the sponsorship identification that is required by both the FCC and the Federal Election Commission, they can add that. But otherwise, they can't touch it. If we're not talking about the candidate, him or herself, or their campaign, if it's a third-party ad, stations have the right to refuse those ads entirely. And the other point is that if there's something in it that is problematic, they can be held legally liable. Whereas for the legally qualified candidates' ads, because they can't censor them, they cannot be held liable for the content. So that's broadcast. And those have been the rules in this country for many, many years. Now we enter the world of social media, and that's a different situation because even though there are people in Congress and probably many people around the country who think that social media should be regulated like broadcast and radio and television are, in fact, we're not there yet. And in fact, the people that operate those platforms are considered basically as publishers, not content creators. And they have, under a relatively old law now called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, they have basically immunity from liability for the content of material that is provided through an ad. So the bottom line is that they can choose not to run the ads, but if they do, they won't be liable for them. The creator of the content would be the one who would be.
I want to go back to that first point. If I'm a candidate for office and I run an ad on a broadcast TV station that says my opponent is literally a werewolf from outer space and will eat you, they have to run it. Like they can't fact check that at all.
And not only can they not fact check it, they can't even, for example, some years ago when there were some extremely graphic anti-abortion ads that were being run by some political campaigns, the television stations went to the FCC and said, well, we think this violates the rules against indecent content, and we think we shouldn't have to run them at all, or if we do, we should be allowed to run them during the safe harbor when children are expected not to be in the audience. And the FCC says, no, you can't do that. You have to run it the way it's presented to you. You have immunity for the content. If there's a problem with the content, they have to go after the candidate or his or her campaign.
But then if I'm with the group Citizens for Good Things and I run that same werewolf ad, the TV station can limit my ability to run that.
Well, they have the right to censor it. And if they choose not to censor it, which is really the point, they could be held legally liable, assuming that there is content there that violates the law. And I think an important point to keep in mind is that the courts and Congress have recognized that political speech enjoys the highest level of protection. And we know that there's a lot of hyperbole in campaign advertising. It's sort of the essence of the way we do campaigns in this country. And since there's really no legal basis to sue somebody just because you don't like what they say, it has to be a false and defamatory statement that can be proven true or false before it could be actionable. And that's almost impossible to prove.
We're talking to Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics at the University of Minnesota, looking at campaign ads by candidates, by their campaigns, by outside groups, and when media outlets can and can't regulate what appears on their airwaves or on their social media sites, as the case may be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Now, social media, correct me if I'm wrong, we kind of treat that as a different thing. It's not a utility. It's just why do we treat it legally differently than that broadcast operation?
Well, because the rationale for regulating broadcast goes back to the idea that the broadcast spectrum is limited. Only a few people can use it. If Wisconsin Public Radio is operating on a particular frequency, nobody else can in that particular jurisdiction. And so it has to be operated in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, which means that one of the obligations is to provide a forum for people to communicate politically. When we talk about social media, it's a completely different ballgame. At least, theoretically, it's unlimited. Anybody can start a social media platform. And the courts and Congress, there have been people in Congress who have been trying to figure out ways to regulate social media, but for the most part, they can't be. The one place that some of your listeners might think would obviously apply would be the Federal Trade Commission be able to come in and regulate under the false advertising law. And the answer is no, they can't, because political ads are not part of the regime that the Federal Trade Commissions can regulate. Where the regulation comes in is in revealing who the sponsors are, who's paying for the ads. And that's why if you watch television or hear radio ads, you always hear who sponsors the ad. And you hear the disclaimer by the candidate if they say, I approve this ad. There have been attempts to enact similar legislation to affect social media. And there's one law called the Honest Ads Act that was sponsored by Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and others back in May. It's been kind of languishing, but what it would do is impose the same kind of sponsorship disclaimers on ads in social media. But again, it goes to the issue of sponsorship. It really doesn't address the issue of content.
I want to get into a couple of the political stories that prompted us to give you a call in the first place, Jane. One, close to home, in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, this TV station sued by the Trump campaign, initially in a local court, ended up in a federal court, I believe, saying that a third-party group's ad was defamatory because of the way they had edited the president's statements together. What do you make of that case?
Well, this ad ran not only in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, but in a number of other stations in other states as well. I'm not quite sure exactly why the Trump campaign chose to go after this particular station, although I suspect because Wisconsin's a battleground state, that might be part of the reason. I would say that they have a very, very tough road to try to make this claim. Again, as I said earlier, there's a huge discretion for candidates and even their third-party campaign or third-party supporters to engage in what we would call rhetorical hyperbole. I think that it's important to remember that a public figure, a public official like President Trump, would have to prove knowledge of falsity, reckless disregard for the truth, and that people were actually being misled by these ads. So my guess is that this is a lawsuit that is brought primarily to try to be a cautionary tale for other stations that might not want to run an ad by this and not have to have the expense of mounting a defense. Because even if you win in a case like this, you've still expended a lot of money mounting your defense in court.
We're talking to Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, looking at what the law says about political ads for those making them and the media outlets broadcasting them or the social media outlets putting them online. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about political ads being misleading or simply fake? Would you like to see more laws regulating the content of political ads? Do you think that TV, say, should be treated differently than social media one way or another? Do you think that social media outlets like Facebook and Twitter should do more or less to regulate what candidates say, what third-party organizations say? What questions do you have about all this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, about the rules for campaigns and groups producing political ads and the media outlets that air them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry about political content, ads from campaigns and other groups? Do you worry about it being misleading, flat out fake? What do you want to know about what news sources can do to monitor that? If stations can block these things, what happens on social media, what the law is, what potential changes are out there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Andrew on the line in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
I just wanted to make a comment about whether or not speech should be regulated by social media companies or any media company. And my view is that you should be able to say whatever it is you'd like to say, but if you are going to make public statements, that there is a responsibility to tell the truth. And if you're found to be lying and it damages an individual or an organization, that you should be able to be held accountable for those statements.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. So Andrew pointing toward, you know, if it's damaging to someone, you should be able to be held accountable. And that's where lawsuits for defamation might come up. How much latitude is there for that in the world of political advertising, Jane?
Well, again, there's a lot of latitude because so much of the speech that we engage in the political sphere is hyperbolic and tends to be extreme. And that's a long, long tradition we have in this country. So trying to carve out specifically facts and specifically facts that are damaging to somebody's reputation is often a very tricky thing to do. Remember that libel law is not about truth. Full stop, period. You know, we don't have a ministry of truth in this country that decides what's true or false factually. The significance of a false fact is related in libel law to whether it's actually damaging somebody's reputation, often very hard to prove in the political sphere.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We also invited listeners to weigh in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dean writes, I would like to see all campaign ads done away with. Campaigns should publish their goals and objectives, and the debate arena should be where they challenge those views. So Dean is not a fan of the genre of political advertising. Probably not going to go away anytime soon, though, is it, Jane?
I don't think so. I mean, remember who would have to abolish it. It would have to be people that run for elective office. And I think the likelihood is they're not going to give up what they see as a very, very powerful tool. And I'd add, it's not just for the campaigns themselves. We know that in the 2016 election, for example, and it's continuing today, that there are a lot of interest groups that use social media as well as the broadcast media to communicate their ideas. And sometimes it's not being done with the best of motives. And it's disturbing and it's frightening. And I think one of the aspects about social media is that the platforms have the option and do it to varying degrees to do what's called micro-target ads, so they can kind of decide which political ads you will see. It's not like turning on over-the-air television and you see whatever is there. You'll get stuff that's triggered to you based on, you know, your gender, your zip code, things like that. And it can be really difficult to determine as a user whether you're getting truthful material or not, because you're being so segmented in what you actually receive. And I personally think that is probably the scariest aspect of all of this.
I want to turn to another thing that prompted our call to you, Jane. Facebook and Twitter removing an ad from the Trump campaign where he had a statement about COVID-19 that both outlets said, hey, wait a minute, this is misinformation. It violates our particular COVID-19 misinformation policies. How much latitude and or responsibility does a venue like Facebook or Twitter have to do that kind of thing?
Well, legally, they're limited by their terms of service, what they say they will do. And the Communications Decency Act that I mentioned before gives them a lot of latitude to make their own editorial choices. It's not technically censorship because they're not governmental entities or an entity that is regulated by the government. And, you know, with all of the discussion in the last few years about fake news and misinformation, I think they've been under a lot of pressure to revise their former kind of laissez-faire policies. You know, we're platforms and we don't want to do anything to interfere with free speech, to realize that they are, in a way, complicit if information that they know is not true is being made available on their platform. So they're doing this, and I think, frankly, to be cynical, they're doing it in large part because they're worried that there could be new regulation or new legislation coming out of Washington, especially if there's a change in the political parties after the next election.
Talking to Jane Curley from the University of Minnesota about political ads from campaigns and from other groups and how the media can and can't regulate false statements in those. Let's go back to your calls now. Lance is with us on the road through in Milwaukee. Lance, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I know that the politicians can lie in their campaigns. I do not think that this is proper, and I would like to know what would we have to do to change that law?
Interesting. Jane, what would it take if we decided, hey, we don't want to allow unlimited lying in a campaign ad?
I think it's a great question. And because of the First Amendment, it's a very difficult thing to try to do. Some years ago, there were a lot of states that passed laws prohibiting libelous speech in campaign ads. Almost every one of those laws has either been struck down or was withdrawn by the legislature because it's just seen as too difficult to enforce. You know, our friends in Europe don't seem to have the same issues that we do here in the United States, and I'm not saying we should adopt those principles. I think, you know, the basic idea under the First Amendment is that the cure for bad speech is more speech. So we want to encourage those who disagree with what appears in an ad to speak out and take it on squarely and address it themselves. The difficulty is who's going to decide what is true. And I think that's a question that has become more and more complicated in the last few years. I don't want a Ministry of Truth making these determinations. I don't want the Federal Election Commission making these determinations, and somebody has to decide it. So that's the thing you always have to ask yourself, who's going to make those decisions? And even when stations or the social media make a decision to censor, as they say, an advertisement, what happens? If they're immediately labeled as censors, suppressing speech, keeping information from the public, it's a very difficult situation to try to address in any way other than saying for the bad speech, the cure is more speech.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into something kind of on the frontiers of technology here. A Trump campaign ad that uses images of Joe Biden where the background is heavily edited. The theme is that he's hiding alone at home. One of the images from a speech Biden gave, it edits out the microphone in his hand, for example. Here's a listen to the ad.
Deep in the heart of Delaware, Joe Biden sits in his basement, alone, hiding, diminished, refusing to answer questions about the crazy far-left ideas he's adopted.
So this ability to manipulate backgrounds in images, I don't know, is there anything, does that run afoul of the law in any way, first of all?
Well, the first thing I'd think of is perhaps copyright. If those are copyrighted images that are being used without permission, it's possible you could bring a copyright infringement claim. There's also perhaps a claim under false light invasion of privacy or under the civil code claim that you can do for right of publicity, where you're using somebody's name or image without compensation. But I think those are all long shots. And one of the realities is that with the new technology that's making it easier to alter images, I think this is a question that we have to address both legally and ethically for journalists and for others and for those that are making these campaign commercials about whether this is really something that they should be doing, even if it's legally permissible for them to do so.
I want to spend some time talking about the audience for these ads, wherever they might see them, social media, online, broadcast, whatever. What advice do you have, Jane, for people watching, knowing that under the law, at least some of what goes on, we can't count on it to be true?
Well, especially if you are depending upon your information, your ads from social media, familiarize yourself with what kind of rules the medium itself has in place, the platform, whether it's Facebook or Google or whoever, about this micro-targeting issue, because it really will affect which ads you see and could easily give you a distorted picture of what's going on in the campaign. For television and radio, obviously, it's sort of the luck of the draw. Again, I think if you're unhappy with what you're seeing, at least with the candidate ads and the candidate campaign ads, you need to talk to them about it, because the television or radio stations are kind of stuck in the federal campaign with running whatever they see. I think we should support this legislation that demands greater accountability in terms of sponsorship. Again, it's not a content issue. It's just making sure we know who's really behind those ads. So personally, I would encourage people to support bills like the Honest Ads bill to try to have greater transparency in who places these ads.
Briefly, Jane, we don't have time for one more caller, but Kevin in Dodgeville says the people themselves need to research, think critically, and question what we're being told. Briefly, good advice?
Best advice, you know, an informed electorate is essential, and I think we owe it to ourselves to take the steps that make us informed.
Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It was really my pleasure.
Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota and co-author of the book Media Ethics Today. She talked with us about the rules around political ads for the groups and campaigns that make them and the media outlets and social media outlets that post them. Coming up, an expert on executive orders joins us to break down the details of President Trump's recent actions and whether they're constitutional without congressional support. And today is primary election day here in Wisconsin, when voters will determine which candidates will be on the final ballot this November. This includes races for the U.S. House of Representatives and for the state legislature. We'll bring you election results online tonight. Once the polls close at 8, go to WPR.org/politics for the latest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson look at today's primary elections, how they went, and what results we know by then. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, over the weekend, President Trump signed 4 executive orders and memos to address the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic.
Through these 4 actions, my administration will provide immediate and vital relief to Americans struggling in this difficult time. And the beautiful thing about this difficult time is we're now coming back and setting records. We'll also ensure that our economic comeback continues full speed ahead.
These orders come after Congress didn't reach a deal on another round of coronavirus relief. Our next guest joins us for a look at the president's executive actions, whether they're constitutional, and the role of executive action like these in general. Daniel Gitterman is a professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's written a book on presidential power titled Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, you've written the book on executive orders. Are these 4 orders from the president over the last week here in line with what we've seen in the past?
They are absolutely in line. He'd issue 3 memos and 1 executive order. They're pretty similar. The memos are usually directives to the head of a federal agency. But clearly, with the failure of Republicans and Democrats in Congress to come to the agreement, he decided to use some authority to act, at least in the short term.
Are we seeing this kind of executive action getting more common lately, given the partisan divides in Congress and the inability to reach decisions on stuff?
I absolutely think both Democrats and Republicans in recent decades and presidencies have increasingly made use of this power, particularly during times of partisan stalemate. Some prior predecessors probably didn't sign them with the fanfare that this president commands. His usually are formal, either press briefings in the Oval Office, or in this case, over his summer vacation.
I want to give a listen to then-candidate Donald Trump talking about executive orders at a rally in Janesville during the presidential campaign. This is back in March of 2016. This comes from C-SPAN.
I want to not use too many executive orders, folks. Executive orders sort of came about more recently. Nobody ever heard of an executive order. Then all of a sudden Obama, because he couldn't get anybody to agree with him, he starts signing them like they're butter. So I want to do away with executive orders for the most part.
So is it easy for somebody outside the White House to say executive action is bad, but the temptation to really be there once you're a president?
I think the incentives are the same for Democrats and Republicans once they get to the White House. And obviously, when you don't like the party that controls the White House, you tend not to like their unilateral actions.
Now, let's take a look at these particular orders. One thing that people have focused in on is the use of funding from some emergency relief funding from FEMA, taking that money and putting it into unemployment relief. And some people have said, wait a minute, that goes beyond the president's executive power because Congress is supposed to be the one that decides on the purse strings. What do you make of that particular use?
I think they tried to hide unemployment compensation within the statutory guidance that was given to Homeland Security and FEMA to give disaster relief. So, in a narrow sense, my guess is it's probably constitutional. There are two pieces of additional information that are important to your listeners. One is that it's not unemployment compensation; it's disaster relief. It allows $400 per recipient, $300 coming from the FEMA disaster relief, but your home state governor is going to have to come up with the additional $100. And so much of this shift, and there's only enough money in the disaster package to last about 4 or 5 weeks. So it will get some folks just over to the Labor Day holiday. It will be $400 versus $600, but it's entirely contingent on governors and state legislators being able to identify the funds to pay the $100 per participant. So the politics are going to shift pretty quickly in the next 4 weeks to the State House.
Talking to Daniel Gitterman, professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, talking about President Trump's recent executive actions and how executive orders and executive memos work in general in the American system of government. Daniel, is there a lot of wiggle room like this for presidents to say, well, yeah, I'm going to fix this unemployment problem, but we'll call it disaster relief? Or in the case of President Obama, we're going to do this thing that we wanted Congress to do with deferred action for childhood arrivals, but we're using our powers of prosecutorial discretion, not actually changing the law. There's a lot of room for action, isn't there?
In my book, I refer to the president as the CEO of the federal bureaucracy. And so all those secretaries, these three orders have a memorandum to the Secretary of Education on student loan debt, Secretary of Treasury on deferring payroll taxes, and the Secretary of Homeland Security and FEMA to try to use whatever discretion within the statutory guidance that they got from Congress. And in each of these cases, it appears, although temporary legal efforts to try to deal with relief in the failure of the deal, the interesting politics will be what happens when they come back to September and these temporary measures are over.
I've seen people make the case over the years, Daniel, that the balance of power has really shifted in recent decades. I don't know how far back you want to go, from the legislative branch and Congress to the executive branch and the president. Do you see that happening, first of all, and how big a part of that, if so, are these executive actions?
Absolutely so. And in order for the president to be checked, one of the other branches have to engage in the checking. The courts, for the most part, have been pretty deferential with some exception to efforts of presidents to act unilaterally. And it really requires Congress to assert its power and responsibility to try to override or block the president. But that requires, for the most part, large majorities and often a two-third majority. If Congress wanted to override one of these executive orders, it would have to both get a majority vote and then sustain a veto on the second round.
Well, speaking of the legislative branch, I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on CNN this Sunday talking about the executive actions.
My constitutional advisors tell me they're absurdly unconstitutional. But right now, our focus, and that's a parallel thing. Right now, the focus, the priority has to be on, again, meeting the needs of the American people.
And one of the questions there for House Democrats was the idea of, well, should we sue the president over the executive actions, which would not be unprecedented. I believe Republicans in the House sued the Obama administration over DACA. That's a little weird. The legislative branch, which has the power to write laws if they want to, turning to the third branch of government to tackle the other one.
Yeah, I don't foresee that there's going to be an immediate court challenge on this. I mean, I am not a law professor, but many of the analyses I've read by some law professors and legal scholars suggest that for the most part, these would probably withstand scrutiny. I think one thing that the president has played to his advantage in impeachment and all these other efforts is he realizes it takes time for the courts to make these decisions, and the political benefits come immediately and are short term, which is exactly what he was looking for.
Talking to Daniel Gitterman, professor of public policy and an expert in presidential executive orders. We're looking at the policy and politics behind President Trump's recent executive actions on COVID-19 economic relief. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the four executive orders signed over the weekend? How would you like Congress to respond? Would you like to see them pass some kind of COVID-19 economic relief package? And what do you think of the use of executive actions, whether it's by a Republican or Democratic president? Do you worry that they get used too much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the executive orders and memos President Trump signed over the weekend. Daniel Gitterman is with us, professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these particular orders from the president? Are they significant? Do you worry that they exceed his power? Would you like Congress to do something to make them irrelevant, in effect, by taking action? In general, do you worry about the use of executive orders, executive memos by presidents to do stuff even when Congress doesn't? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like your guest to comment on one of the big impasses that they currently have in the legislative branch that is blocking relief for the pandemic. Specifically, the Democrats are asking that a large sum of money be allocated to mismanaged blue states, such as Illinois, that have huge deficits. They want to use the pandemic to pay off the debt that goes for mismanagement of the state finances. And the Republican side is saying, no, we're not going to allow you to use a pandemic for mismanaged financial situations. I would like to say, what do you do in that situation where they are blocking needed relief for people due to a political situation that for unrelated mismanagement?
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Not too much time left. That's the Republican characterization. Democrats saying we're trying to get support to all state and local governments to deal with COVID-19. But Charlie pointing correctly to that being one of the sticking points here that led to the need, as President Trump saw it, for executive action. What do you think, Daniel?
Absolutely. I mean, there were multiple parts of this. Some of it was aid to localities and states, and the lack of agreement and concerns about the deficit caused a stalemate, and some of these other important measures on unemployment and other forms of relief are still left undecided.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charlie, at 800-642-1234. You can also post, by the way, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on another caller now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering, it was my impression that this administration has used the executive directive or executive power quite a bit less than the previous administration or two. I'm wondering if you have the numbers for those.
Yeah, what do we see in the trends of the use of executive orders, and where does the Trump administration stack up, Daniel?
You know, I have not seen the latest numbers. I think I looked at them after maybe year two and year two and a half, and the numbers were on par with his immediate predecessors. There's a belief he's done more. There's some belief he's done less. I would say he's done about the same, but commands a lot more attention when he signs them.
Thanks for the call, Jim. When we look at the last couple of administrations, though, is the general trend upward for presidents to do this more?
I think you, historically, no. FDR issued far more. But I would say since during the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994, you certainly saw an uptick in the use of this when things broke down in a partisan stalemate.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim. Time for one more caller. Mitch is with us in Plover. Mitch, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
What'd you want to bring up, Mitch?
I had a question on what effect the payroll tax deferment would have, because as I understand it, it is just a deferment, so it's still going to be due at the end of 2021 or whenever that executive order ends, and how that's going to affect businesses that don't pay it at the time when the time comes due, or are people going to continue paying it, and how that's going to affect.
Thanks a lot for that call. It sounds like you dropped out there, but Daniel, you got the gist of that payroll tax executive order. How does that all play out?
I did. It is temporary. I believe goes through December 31st. Now, the president promised if he was reelected, he was going to make the payroll tax cut permanent. But a permanent payroll tax cut and its implications for cuts in Medicare and Social Security financing does not have much bipartisan support.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Daniel, what are you watching for when it comes to the future of how presidents use these executive orders and memos?
I think regardless of party, one has to just appreciate the incentives that the actor, the president, has to try to pursue his goals or her goals unilaterally. And so I think it's become very much a tool of policymaking, and it really is going to require Congress and not the courts to begin to rein in president power.
And just briefly, is it a bad thing if these are overused, if that power isn't reined in?
Well, I mean, I think in this particular episode, they were innovative ways to buy a little time after failed negotiations, but they do not make up for the permanency of federal law.
We'll leave it there, Daniel. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again, Rob. Be well.
You too. Daniel Gitterman is a professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's written a book on presidential power. It's called Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. You can weigh in on our conversation today over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've been talking about the policy and politics of President Trump's most recent executive orders. Wisconsin has crossed a sobering threshold. As of today, more than 1,000 people in the state have been killed by the novel coronavirus. This week, we're going to start meeting some of the victims of the pandemic. Rachel Vasquez starts with the story of a couple who died within hours of one another.
Wilford and Mary Kepler were married for more than 70 years. They spent most of their life in the Milwaukee area working and raising a family, including their son, Michael Kepler, who I spoke to outside of his home in July.
My dad always liked to joke around, and he liked, he made corny jokes, and we always groaned at most of his jokes, but he liked telling them and enjoyed getting the reaction.
Mary, on the other hand, loved to dance and had what her son calls spark.
If we were at a wedding and friends of mine were sitting around, she'd go up and ask them to dance, and if she wouldn't get a dance from one of the people, she'd make sure that the next person down would be asked to dance. So she liked to be out there on the dance floor.
Wilford and Mary were both born in southwestern Wisconsin in the 1920s. They grew up during the Great Depression.
Money was an issue for both the families, I know that for sure. It was very, very tight.
When Wilford was 18, he was drafted into the Navy to fight in World War II. Mike says his dad went all over the Pacific Ocean treating soldiers who were wounded, like in the Battle of Okinawa, when Wilford treated a sailor whose ship had been hit by kamikaze planes.
I know he stayed up with one of the sailors coming off that ship who had been badly injured. He stayed up with the guy all night, just making sure that he knew that somebody was there for him.
That's also when he started talking to Mary, who was a cheerleader at our high school in Richland Center. Mary started writing letters to Wilford, and when he got back home...
And then when he came back from the war, I think he probably made a beeline to her door.
They got married in 1946, and their three kids came after that. Wilford worked as a machinist around Milwaukee, and Mary picked up factory jobs too, eventually ending up at U.S. Steel.
Family, again, made much of what they could in our society, and our society, luckily for them, opened up and did allow these people to have decent incomes and raise wonderful families.
Wilford, 94, and Mary, 92, started feeling sick in April. Their daughter was staying with them, and a few weeks into feeling sick, she took her mom to get tested. The results showed that both she and Mary were positive for COVID-19. So they told Wilford.
When she told him that the results had come back on a positive COVID test for both her and my mother, she said he got tears in his eyes, so I think he knew that the end was near.
After they were feeling sick and run down for weeks, Wilford fell, injuring his head. Both Wilford and Mary were admitted to a local hospital where Wilford tested positive for the virus, and then his condition got worse.
After a day or two in the ICU unit, they moved him to the same ward that my mother was in. They moved them into the same room, and they moved their beds together, so a very nice gesture on the part of the hospital. We're very happy with that.
Wilford died as a result of his head injuries early in the morning on April 18th, and Mary died from coronavirus complications just hours later.
Well, for me, the grief was, I would say, almost overwhelming for the first two or three weeks. It was, tears were constantly in my eyes, and it's gotten better.
Mike says he wasn't prepared to lose both of his parents so quickly.
I think the fact that they died from the pandemic, the fact that the pandemic has upset our national sense of well-being, and the fact that they died so closely together, boom, all of a sudden they were gone. It was like 9 or 10 days after the onset of the disease, both of them were gone. So it was a terrible shock.
He says his parents dedicated themselves to their family, and that family that's now grown to include grandchildren and great-grandchildren will be their biggest legacy. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can follow more reporting on COVID-19 here in Wisconsin at WPR.org/news and at wiscontext.org. And today is primary election day here in Wisconsin, when voters will determine which candidates will be on the final ballot this November. It includes races for the U.S. House of Representatives and for seats in the state legislature. We'll bring you election results online tonight. Once the polls close at 8, go to WPR.org/politics for the latest and tune into the Ideas Network tomorrow to find out how voting went around the state and what results we know. Also, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly roundup of the latest news in national politics with a look at the presidential race, the reaction to executive orders from the president, and more. The selection of a vice presidential candidate has changed a lot over the years. We'll find out why the old rules don't apply and what it means for running mates in the 21st century, and what might have led to Kamala Harris getting the nod to be Joe Biden's running mate. And we'll find out why a beach on Milwaukee's Lake Michigan shoreline has been made into one of the most accessible beaches in the country. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a retired U.S. Army general joins the show to talk about efforts to prevent racism in the American military. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, is American agriculture sustainable in the long run? The author of the new book, Perilous Bounty, says we need some big changes to maintain our food supply and to protect the land and water that produce it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.